You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
If you spend a Saturday afternoon in Prospect Park, the parade grounds, or the sandlots on the Lower East Side, you'll see kids with a true passion for the game of baseball and an undying love for the Mets or Yankees. Many of them fantasize playing for one of the hometown teams someday. Well, Willie Randolph was one of those kids when he was growing up in Brooklyn, and in his case, the dream came true. Over the course of 13 seasons, playing second base for the New York Yankees, Mr. Randolph won two World Series rings, served as co-captain, was named to the American League All-Star team six times. Later, as a coach for the Yanks, he was part of an additional four World Series championship teams. And then he became the first African-American manager in New York City history for the New York Mets. In a book called The Yankee Way, Playing, Coaching, and My Life in Baseball, published by It Books, Willie Randolph writes about his life in pinstripes and takes us inside the myth and reality of one of the greatest dynasties in sports. And I'm thrilled to welcome him to our show today. Hello.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
The Yankees beat the Mets 1-0 last night to split their four-game Subway Series. The Mets won the first two games at Yankee Stadium, and then the Yankees won there, too, at Citi Field. So much for home field advantage.
Yeah.
As a native New Yorker with deep ties to both teams, what do you make of all of this?
Well, you know, it's always been a huge rivalry. You know,
is it as powerful for the players as it is for the fans?
Well, it can be, but you know, the cast of characters have changed over the years, and so it's always at its height when the players understand what it means. And right now, the only one left from the core four is Derek Jeter. So a lot of these guys that are coming in, they hear about it. It's exciting, but they don't have the real flavor of it, you know. And even some of the Mets, they have a young nucleus. David Wright is the only one there, so these young kids are getting a taste of it for the first time. So the luster and, you know, and the real, you know, teeth of it kind of lost a little bit, but it's great for the fans. It's really more for bragging rights. It's really more for the media trying to build up the drama. And, but you know, the players still enjoy it because National League, American League, and it's for bragging rights of the city.
Well, you could ask about pressure, but I assume pressure is always on every game, every at-bat.
Well, more so for the Yankees, because that game, when Mr. Steinbrenner was around, if we lost that game, we took a lot of heat from Mr. Steinbrenner. So the Mets always had that little, well, okay, we lose, we're supposed to. But we had this extra pressure that we lost, we would feel the wrath of George.
Well, you called your book The Yankee Way. Was that the wrath of George?
The Yankee Way?
Yeah.
No.
What is the Yankee Way?
Well, to me, you know, everyone has their own definition of the Yankee Way. But to me, I equate it to, I define it by championships, winning, you know, legacy, tradition. You know, I've been with the Yankees. I've been around baseball almost four decades. And I grew up in New York City, in Brownsville, Brooklyn. And when I became a Yankee, I felt instantly that real connection to history and legacy. So for me, it means, you know, character, championships, legacy, tradition, and winning. 27 world championships, that's a lot. That's a lot of wins.
Well, you were drafted in the seventh round by the Pittsburgh Pirates.
Mm-hmm.
What would have happened if you hadn't batted? What did you bat? 156 or something like that?
Yeah, I was. Well, when I came up to the team, I was that. But I hit like 320 something in AAA. So I had a small window when I got to the team. I didn't have many at bats. But I went to Venezuela that year to play winter ball, and that's when the trade came about.
But if you hadn't been traded to the Yanks, you might have been at Pittsburgh. You actually did wind up playing six different teams over your career.
Yeah.
Still, you might have had a whole career in Pittsburgh. Do you think you would have had a very different sense of baseball
if you
weren't playing for your hometown team?
Well, you know, I still think it would have been baseball, and I would have loved it and been honored and privileged to put the uniform on, because that's the way it is. It's really a privilege. But I think sometimes how things would have worked out in my career, because the Pittsburgh Pirates have always had a big, long lineage of great second basemen. And I was in that round, but I don't know where I would have fit. And Rennie Stennett was there at the time, so I could have been a utility player, a backup guy, and never got the opportunity.
Well, you arrived on a team that looks like an all-star team. If you just look at every player in the 25 of the 25 players, had an incredible career.
Yes, starting with the Pirates, with guys like Willie Stargell and those guys. And then with the
great pitching.
The pitching we had there, Steve Blass. class, and well, Doc Ellis was on LSD at the time, so I don't know if that was a good thing.
he claimed he pitches no hitter on LSD.
That's what he said, and he had hair colors in his hair and in the bullpen, and I'm like, Doc, what are you doing? Bad example to set for a young kid from Brooklyn. But then I went to the Yankees, and greats like Thurman Munson, Roy White, Chris Chambliss, Catfish Hunter, those guys really taught me the ropes.
So when you're a kid and you come on a team, there are the role models who actually help you get through and understand better. Well, you grew up in Brownsville, you said.
Mm-hmm.
There's no Little League in Brownsville, is there?
Well, at the time there was Little Leagues, but it was always sponsored Little Leagues. A corner grocery store, you know, a department store, a church, you know, Our Lady of Mercy, Jimmy's grocery store. The only way we get uniforms with these people was sponsoring for us, and we had fathers and mentors in the community that would take their time to take us to the ballpark and have a catch with us and everything like that.
And what team were you rooting for?
Back then, I grew up a Met fan, ironically, because I grew up around 1969, where the Mets were the underdog against the mighty Baltimore Orioles. And when they won the World Series, me and my friends, we were dancing in the streets. It was so unbelievable.
Now, today, I suspect that many of those kids who were playing baseball with you would be playing basketball instead. What do you think's changed?
Well, that's another excellent question, because that's something that we need a lot of time to talk about, because I think we are losing a generation of African-American kids not playing sports. I just think that...
Well, they're playing football or basketball.
Football and basketball, because they see a quicker way to that pot of gold by going to college for a year or two and then signing a professional contract, hopefully. Baseball is a grind. You have to be with it for a long time. There's patience involved in going through the minor league system, and I don't think kids really are patient enough to go through that, you know?
Did any of the kids that you played with make it into professional ball?
One or two. I played against, like Lee Mazzilli, Johnny Franco, Pete Falcone. Those guys grew up in my era. John Candelaria, another local guy.
Who was with the Pirates.
But the Pirates, when we first came up together. And I think we signed the same year, I think. Both of us came out about the same year, 1972. But you know, I played with guys in my neighborhood who were actually better than me, but they just didn't believe the dream. They didn't think that it would materialize for them, and they stayed in the old neighborhood. When I went to Prospect Park to be exposed to scouts, that's when my career kind of took off.
When was it apparent to you that you were good enough to have a chance of playing in the major leagues?
Well, I always wanted to do it, you know, and it's always a dream as a youngster to be in the big leagues. But it wasn't until maybe my second year in professional baseball. I was in AA. It was in a little town called Thetford Mines, Canada. That's where our AA affiliate was. And I really started to see how I stacked up competitively with all the other kids. I was a smallish guy. I was not the biggest guy, of course, as far as, you know, draft picks. But I found myself competing with these guys and doing well. And so my confidence started to grow. And that's when I felt, you know what, I got a chance to do this.
Well, when they draft you, they're looking at all sorts of things, mm-hmm. what the various tools you would have. Mm-hmm. One of the tools they don't really take into account as much as they should, I think, is the mental tool.
No doubt about it, mental toughness. That's right.
And I'm getting the feeling from you that the mental part is a key factor.
Oh, very much so. You know, you have to believe in yourself, have confidence. The competition is fierce. And so if you go in there with a real belief in your ability, you're going to fall by the wayside. It's the competition from top to bottom, from A ball to AA to AAA. You're going against the best players in the country. So if you don't believe in yourself, and me coming from a tough background, that kind of prepared me for that in a way.
Had you expected to be drafted higher than the seventh round?
Yeah. Well, I didn't know where I would go. To me, I could have went in the thousandth round. I wouldn't have cared. But I didn't really know how to measure myself being in a small town, in a small town where we didn't have big exposure. When I got signed, I was like, kind of, just give me the contract. I'll sign it. Let's go. That's it. I could have signed for a dollar and I would have been happy.
My guest is Willie Randolph, who has written a memoir called The Yankee Way, Playing, Coaching, and My Life in Baseball. You must have been thrilled, obviously, when you were traded to the Yanks a very bad trade for the Pirates.
Yeah, it was because
three good players came to the Yanks.
Yeah, and Doc Medich, who ended up being a doctor, only played for the Pirates for 1 year, and then he went to be a doctor. So that was a real bust for them. They thought they were going to get this guy who's going to be their starting pitcher for 10 years, and it worked out the way. I thought I was a throw-in, actually. Actually, when that trade was made, I was so naive that I thought I had to go and really prove myself. But the Yankees really wanted me.
And then you as a throw-in, let's look at the end of your playing career. You ranked fifth in Major League history in games at second base, mm-hmm. ninth in putouts, seventh in assists, eighth in total chances, and third in double plays. Well,
pretty cool, huh?
I think you have a lot to be proud of for a throw-in.
Yes, yes.
Now, how about, you mentioned some of your teammates. What about managers? It's never clear how important a manager is to whether a team wins or loses. Because I look at some of the managers who do really well 1 year, and then 2 years later, they're fired because the team is losing badly.
Yeah.
The players are disgruntled.
Yeah, yeah.
They loved them. They loved them when they were winning. Hate them now.
Unfortunately. Yeah.
Well, you were a manager, so you must have thought a lot about that.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that you're as a leader, you prepare your team every day to play the game. You know, hopefully, you have good players who are on the same page as far as your philosophy and how to implement that. And the pressure to win nowadays is so fierce that you know the manager does get the blame when it comes. You can't fire 25 guys, as they always say. But to me, I think players need to be held more accountable. You know, these kids are making tremendous salaries. God bless them. But I just think that they're not as held accountable for the job that they do. They'd rather fire the manager than get rid of the guy. So, again, it's just something you have to kind of deal with. It goes with the program. Today, it's even more heightened because of all the scrutiny and all the media attention you get. But that's what you sign up for.
So who were your favorite managers? Was it somebody like Billy Martin or was it a Joe Torre? Or?
Yeah, I've been fortunate and very blessed to be with some great, great managers. My first influence was Billy Martin. And a lot of people, a lot of guys didn't like Billy Martin very well because he was a tough manager. But for some reason, you know, he took me under his wing.
He had played second base.
Second base, yeah. He taught me the ropes a little bit. He saw I was a tough kid from Brownsville, Brooklyn. And you just took a liking to each other. But Billy probably wasn't the best strategist for the guys I've been around, like the Joe Torres or Tony La Russa's, Tommy Lasorda, Yogi Berra. But he got the most out of his team, albeit for a small period of time because he was self-destruct with the alcohol, and that's what was downfall. But he got the most out of the Yankees. It was us against the world. He instilled that in his players, and he got the most out of his players by taking that attitude.
You mentioned a number of catchers when you were talking about strategists, catchers who became managers. And a lot of catchers have been successful managers. Do you think that they have an advantage over second basemen because they're the ones who are calling the game?
Yeah, I think they do. I think they have a different insight to what's going on. Pitching is very important in the game. And if you can control pitching, if you can understand how to make your moves, that's a big part of winning. But I think that what happens after a while is that, you know, we're a copycat league, you know, and so all of a sudden now the catcher is the flavor of the month, so we get all these catchers coming through. But if you're a baseball guy, if you're a student of the game, it doesn't matter if you're a catcher, center field, outfielder, but, you know, a lot of catchers have done a good job.
Who was on the Mets team when you were managing?
The players I had? Oh, I had an excellent team. I had David Wright at third base. He's the only one left from that team, actually. Jose Reyes, a young Jose Reyes, Carlos Delgado, Carlos Beltran, Johnny Franco. Johnny Franco. I played with Johnny Franco, but Billy Wagner. I had a nice team, man, and, we accomplished a lot.
And you lasted 3.5 years.
3.5 years, one pitch from going to the World Series. You know, that curveball that Wainwright threw with Beltran, it was a hellacious curveball, and he couldn't pull this trigger. But
Mets fans have never forgiven Carlos Beltran. I guess we're happy that he's with the Yanks now.
Yeah, but he did a tremendous job for me. Carlos, it was devastating for all of us, but he had a great series for me, a great year for me. He's probably one of the best free agent signings the Mets have ever had, you know. So I felt bad for him because he took a lot of hits for that, but he did a good job for us.
Well, there's always talk about chemistry on a team. Mm-hmm. Recently, we had Mookie Wilson here, and he was talking about the Mets team that won the World Series with some incredible players, but players who a number of whom self-destructed. And you've known Doc Gooden and Daryl Strawberry,
good friends of mine. Yeah.
They probably would have been in the Hall of Fame if they hadn't had those problems.
No doubt about it. You know,
So what does a manager do when he sees somebody like that destroying his own life?
Well, you don't really know. You see it, but you're not sure because, you know, off the field, these guys are very private and they go their own way. I mean, you want to intervene if you see it blatantly in front of you or whatever, but I don't know if they really was that privy to what was really going on. Players come to the ballpark, they're ready to play. You know, no one's coming hungover or anything like that, but there's only so much you can do because, you know, especially when you deal with cocaine, I guess, it takes over you, and even if you try to camouflage it or hide it, it's a hideous disease, and it's tough to really get involved. And if you help someone, if they're not ready to accept that, you know, they're going to do it anyway.
Well, we... people bragged about the fact that Babe Ruth would come
to
the ballpark with a serious hangover.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he hit 60 home runs.
I know.
Without steroids.
Yeah, without that's true.
there's a long tradition of people, in fact, alcoholism and
no
baseball.
Doubt.
But cocaine's different? In terms of Doc Ellis says.
Well, the way it affects you, no doubt. I mean, you know, your skills are going to deteriorate because it just saps all your energy and everything. And it's so addictive that you can't play every day 162 games and be strong and stay solid. No doubt about that.
Willie Randolph spent 13 years as a second baseman on the New York Yankees from 1976 to 1988. He's written a book called The Yankee Way: Playing, Coaching, and My Life in Baseball. It's published by It Books. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we are back with Willie Randolph. He has written a book called The Yankee Way: Playing, Coaching, and My Life in Baseball. Now, you called this The Yankee Way, but you played with six different teams.
Mm-hmm.
What happens when you're traded away from the team that you've made such a strong emotional commitment to?
Well, it was an adjustment initially because I was with the Yankees for 13 years, from 76 to 1988. I became a free agent for the first time. And that's when baseball was kind of playing the collusion game, you know, and I got caught up into that. So, in essence, Steve Sachs and I actually switched positions. Steve Sachs came from the Dodgers to the Yankees, and I went from the Yankees to the Dodgers. So I was devastated at the time. I really was hoping that I would finish my career with the Yankees. I was still captain of the team, but they made a change. I understand that's part of the business. So I went to L.A., got a chance to work with Tommy Lasorda, the great Tommy Lasorda, and I got a chance to make the National League as an all-star, which was something that I was a fan of when I was a kid. So another dream realized, okay?
Well, it's been a business for a long time. I remember how unhappy Jackie Robinson was mm-hmm. when he was traded at the end of his career.
Yeah, yeah.
Babe Ruth was traded, actually. He ended up in the Dodgers.
You have to uproot your family and everything. It's a big adjustment.
And it's a surprise that someone like Derek Jeter he's the rarity,
Very rare. Mariano Rivera, very rare that the players stick with a club for their whole career. So it's just unique, very unique.
When you were hired as the manager for the New York Mets, mm-hmm. you became the first African-American to manage a major league team in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
Were you surprised that it took so long?
Yes. To be honest with you, yes, a little bit, because I even thought that I would get shot with the Yankees first, you know. But Joe was there. Eventually, you know, Joe Girardi took over, who's doing an excellent job. But, yeah, my heart was into maybe – because I was a coach for like 13 years there, so I thought the transition would be perfect for me.
Well, were you aware of the fact that the Yanks were one of the last teams to have African-American
yes.
players?
Yes, that's true.
It's one of the scandals of the Yankees. The Dodgers were first and then a number of other teams.
Yes.
But the Yanks took
time.
Years and years. Who was the first one?
Elston Howard, I believe, was the first. Yeah,
yeah. It had to be a great player like Elston Howard.
Yeah, yeah. And he was, actually. He was another one of my early mentors also.
So you grew up, we were mentioning earlier Darryl Strawberry and Dwight Gooden. You mm-hmm. grew up in Brownsville.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have certain insight into troubled players like them? Because you probably had seen drugs.
We grew up in an era that it was where it was more gangs and you know, that kind of thing going. It was drugs everywhere. So, yeah, I had a lot of friends who I saw succumb to substances. And but it wasn't the shooting back then. You know, you have the gangs and they stab each other and sticks and stuff like that. Or they would use their fists, you know, to fight for another day if they had to. But, yeah, I grew up in a rough neighborhood. Sports really kept me out of that, really. I mean, they didn't really mess with the athletes. They've kind of protected us in a way.
They respected you because you had skills.
Yeah, because you were doing something positive. You know, you weren't into the wrong element. You know, you were out having a good time. So we had a group of guys, and we had our own little clique anyway. So if we were intimidated by anyone, we would kind of look after each other because we were a team.
You played on the Yankees through the bad years as well.
'80s?
The entire decade of the 80s.
Yeah.
Some of those teams were okay, others not
much.
Well,
we won more games than any team in the 80s, but we didn't have pitching back then, and our pitching was short. We had great offensive teams, but the thing that hurt us in the 80s is that we didn't have much pitching, so that's why we didn't win a lot of championships, but we won more games than anyone.
Well, who was responsible for not having good pitching? Was that George Steinbrenner's fault? Because he really was a hands-on owner.
Yeah, no, it wasn't really his fault because he always went out and got us the best players if he could. Just that the players that we got, they didn't really stand up in New York. I mean, some of these guys were intimidated with the city, intimidated with the media. So they were good in other places, but when they came to the Yankees, they had that little deer in the headlights look where they didn't really produce.
And I've always wondered about that. It seems to me that if you're a professional, whether you're in a small market or a big market.
No, dealing with pressure. No, New York's a different animal.
Is it because of the press?
Yes, the press and just the pressure, the expectations. They pay you a lot of money. So instead of just enjoying that gift and that privilege, you start to put undue pressure on yourself and you become out of yourself. So some guys deal with it different than others. But for the most part, a lot of these guys just weren't what they call New York kind of guys or whatever to deal with the expectations.
And then there are some people who seem to be New York kind of guys.
Yeah.
After the Yanks lost to the Cincinnati Reds in the 1976 World Series, George Steinbrenner went out and signed Reggie Jackson mm-hmm. to a 5-year contract. He was a New York kind of guy.
Yeah, he loved the stage. He thought he was on Broadway. Reggie always had a big ego. You know, he was out in California with the Oakland A's, had some great years, some great teams out there. But he wanted to be where everyone could, name a candy bar after him. That's what they did, you know. But Reggie loved the attention. He loved to be in the spotlight. And in 1977, he hit those three big home runs to win a world championship. That's what he came to town for.
Mr. October.
Yes, that's right.
Was the dynamic between Reggie and Billy Martin, who was then the Yankees manager, as explosive as it has been rumored?
Yes. It was just all ego. You know, I don't know. Sometimes, you know, people clash for some reason. Billy thought he was the face of the franchise. Reggie didn't try to be the face, but he was very braggadocious, and he didn't care. He didn't mind saying that to people, and Billy took exception to that. So really, it was a kind of that tit-for-tat kind of ego thing that was going on.
Well, I've always wondered about how 25 players and then a bunch of coaches who have very different kinds of personalities ever get through a whole year without killing each other.
It's tough. We were like a big family, and we go through the same things that families go through. Some guys like each other, some guys don't. But the bottom line is that you put that aside when you walk into the field and you play for the fans and get the job done.
Well, a lot has been made of that Yankee team that Reggie joined in 1977, mm-hmm. the so-called Bronx Zoo atmosphere.
Yeah.
Looking back on it, were those times really as crazy as they've been portrayed?
Well, looking back, they were. They really were because, I used to resent the fact that people would refer to us as the Bronx Zoo. But we had a lot of characters on that team. You know, George and Billy were feuding. You know, Reggie and Billy were feuding. Thurman and Reggie didn't get along. So there was always something going on. And again, when you're in the media capital of the world, a lot of stuff, it gets blown out of proportion sometimes, you know.
But then you can put all of that aside when you're in the game?
Yes. You know, we were tough enough. We understood our responsibility, and we were able to, for the most part, put it aside because we won a lot of games, and even though we seemed dysfunctional at times, we were able to separate that, and good professional athletes can do that.
Now, you also named co-captain of the Yankees mm-hmm. from 86 to 88. Who chooses the captain?
It's an organizational decision. I mean, Mr. Steinbrenner has to sign off on it, obviously. But I remember Billy Martin was the first one to tell me that they were considering doing that. Prior to that, I thought I was already the unofficial captain because I had been there. I learned from the greats like Thurman Munson. So I felt I was ready for that honor. When it finally came, along with Ron Guidry, it was a tremendous honor, one of the biggest I've ever had.
Well, the captain not only has to be somebody who is achieved, but he has to have the respect of the other players.
Yes.
And do you have certain responsibilities? Are you the guy who had to call a team meeting when things are going bad?
If need be, yeah. You know, captains wear different hats, and certain captains are boisterous, and some guys are really laid back. Greg Nettles was, I think, maybe the seventh, sixth captain or whatever, but he was very laid back, but he led by example. Most of the time, you lead by example. If you need to tweak things in the clubhouse, guys have gripes, they can come to you, but you really got to go out there and lead by example. Help your teammates, you know, kind of put out any brush fires that are in the clubhouse. That's kind of what a captain does, among other things, but with different teams, depending on if you're a young team or a veteran team, the captain role is defined in different ways.
Did you get along well with George Steinbrenner? Some people felt that he was everything wrong with an owner because he just got too involved in the running of the team. If a player made a couple of errors, he was ready to trade him, which is, of course, ballplayers look at a whole season or even a whole career when they evaluate a player, not a couple of bad plays.
Yeah. Well, George, yes, he was a tough boss. And, you know, we all understood what we were getting into when we signed up with George. He just wanted to win. He just wanted to get the job done every year. I got along pretty well with him. We had our differences, but we were able to do it behind closed doors. So it worked out pretty well. But George really loved his players. He loves the fans. And so even though he was tough, I kind of liked the fact that he was honest like that because it kept us on our toes, you know. It helped you accountable. I think that
he call you into his office when things were going bad?
We had the strike in 88, and when we got back to playing again, I had a charity tournament that I was already committed to, and we had a workout that day. I couldn't go to the workout, so George got upset with me. He fined me. We went back and forth a little bit. He ended up doing the right thing at the end of the day by giving me the money that on the fine and donated to the charity. So he always had a big heart. He was always very giving. So even though he had a rough side to him, there was also a soft side to George.
Well, we're thinking a lot about owners of teams these days because of what's happened at the L.A. Clippers.
Yeah.
But does it really matter whether the owner of a team is a good guy or a bad guy?
No, it doesn't really. I mean, he signs the checks, and he has the right. I mean, you talk about George. I mean, he wants to be a tough boss. He has the right. That's his team. He owns the team. So you can't really you might not like it, but you know what? The players shouldn't have to worry about that because you get paid to do a job. Go out and do your job.
And it got him a lot of mentions on Seinfeld.
It did. And he loved that, too. He thought he was a celebrity.
If you would like to join in this conversation with Willie Randolph, we invite you to give us a call at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. Or you can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. What do you say to people who tell you that baseball is just too slow and, if anything, it's getting slower?
Well,
and what does that mean to the players who are out there for hours and hours and hours?
Baseball is a methodical game. So, yeah, can we speed it up a little bit? I think so. But that's the beauty of it. You know, you're out on a beautiful, leisurely sunny afternoon. The sun's out. You're having a beer and a hot dog with your kids or whatever. That's okay. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, yes, we can speed it up a little bit, but there's nuances. There's strategies that go involved. There's a thinking man's game. So I don't know. I mean, listen, if you don't like baseball, and I don't see how you can't, then you do other sports or whatever. But I think that it's very rare and unique. It's America's pastime. It's all apple pie and all that stuff. I love it, but I think that there's ways to speed it up a little bit, keep guys in the box, not put a clock on them, because baseball is really the only sport that doesn't have a clock. You know, and the game sometime when you get to 3 to 3.5 hours, that is kind of long. But listen, some people love that. And it's the beauty of the game.
Well, I know that if I were out there in the blazing sun and a pitcher was one of those pitchers who just took forever between every pitch, I'd be going out to the mound once in a while saying, can we just do this a little faster?
I've done that a few times, you know, like, can we get it going? That's like a human rain delay here, all right? Come on, let's go.
But you also mentioned that it's a mental game. And I've always been fascinated by the game between the pitcher and the batter.
Yes.
You're going up there and you're thinking, well, with this count, I'm going to get a fastball. Instead, you get a slider.
Yes.
And is that why you swing and miss?
Well, yeah, sometimes I didn't like to guess. Some guys do guess, and that's why you swing and miss. But if you hit the right location and you have enough velocity on your pitch, you can get it by the guy. It's a cat and mouse thing. It's the art of hitting. The pitcher's trying to throw your pitch that his pitch that you can hit, and you're trying to get a pitch that you can hit. And it's really a matching of wits and patience. And so to me, it's a beautiful waltz, if you will, you know. And I've always enjoyed that competition.
And I've also spoken to pitchers and asked them why they throw 5 perfect pitches and the next one is hit out of the ballpark. And they say, well, it's all because of the release point.
Yes.
But
or you make a mistake. You know, you get a ball.
Mistakes are important.
Yeah. You can't always get it where you want it to go, the ball.
And I'm sure that also happens with second baseman. You sometimes just you go to your left to a play that you've done a million times before. And this time, something goes wrong.
You get a little lazy. The ball might make a bad hop or whatever it might be. But it takes a lot of focus and concentration. But, yes, those are parts of the game. Errors are always a part of the game. When my players make an error, I don't get mad at them as long as it's an aggressive error. Okay. But if it's a lazy area where you don't move your feet or get in position, then that's totally different.
Let's take a couple of calls. John from Bergen County, hi, you're on the air.
Hello, I have a quick question for Lloyd. They keep saying that the catcher calls the game. If that's the case, why does the catcher keep looking at the dugout and he's looking for the bench coach to give him direction or call the balls and strikes, what the pitch should be?
Yeah.
Is the catcher making the call or is it the bench coach?
No, the catcher's looking over at the dugout for throwovers. Usually for, you know, if the guy wants to pick the guy off or whatever. Most managers allow the pitcher and the catcher to do their thing. They prepare them before the game and they let them do what they need to do. I don't think it's fair to tell a pitcher what he needs to throw. Now, in the lower levels in the minor leagues, they might get away with that. But in the professional level, what the catcher's doing is looking to see if the coach wants them to throw over to first base and pick the guy off.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.
And so you would, as the manager, you would send over that signal? You'd have a coach send it out for you?
If I had a feeling that the guy was going to try to steal the base, if I wanted to pitch out or something of that nature, then I would give that to the catcher because he gives all the signs and everyone's watching his signals, and that's what would dictate the play.
Bob from Rego Park, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, Willie, how you doing, guy?
I'm great.
You're a classy guy, Bob. I'd like to ask you a question. During the time you were a player as well as a coach, in spring training and during the season against your competitors, when you would see these big, strong muscles with chest muscles, arm muscles, thigh muscles, were you aware of steroid use during your career and your coaching career?
Well, it was pretty much during my coaching career. There was a couple guys that was a suspect when I played. You know, they talked about Brian Downing or Brady Anderson, those guys. You know, you just wasn't sure. But when I became a coach, I started noticing these kids coming back from spring training bigger than they should have looked at the time. There's no way you can gain that much bulk in 4 to 5 months in the offseason. So that's when I started to see something a little fishy. You know, it wasn't prevalent. It wasn't in your face. If whatever they did was behind closed doors or away from the field. And as a coach, you know, we don't really always dress in the locker room. We dress in a different space, so we don't always see these guys doing this stuff. So it was there, obviously, when they started coming out with androstenedione and creatine. We could see the protein powder, but that was kind of more of a camouflage, really. They were doing more than that, obviously.
But weren't you curious about what was happening when Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa suddenly were breaking all of those records? Something was going on there, or was it just a moment where great home run hitters were coming up?
We all knew and saw something. Major League Baseball did. The media did. We all have egg on our face here. There's no doubt about it. No one should look like, well, you know, why you didn't know. We all knew, but unless you have direct proof, you can't really accuse someone of something until you know there's proof. So when they started testing, because back then there was no testing. You know, why do you think Barry Bonds did it? Because he felt like Mark McGwire was stealing all of his thunder. He was getting paid more, so he did it too. But there was no testing. Now that there's testing, you see it going away now.
And then there are some players who continue to deny, like Roger Clemens.
Well, you know, you can deny.
You knew
deny.
Roger.
But yeah, I knew Roger real well. I played against Roger. He was a teammate and a great teammate. But, you know, the eye test and public opinion, you know, you can't get away from that. But he got bigger. You know, he threw harder. So you figure there was something going on. When I first started noticing things were fishy, guys, is when these little infielders were going opposite field. Now, it's one thing if you get the head of the bat out and you pull the ball. That's traditionally what happens. But I always see kids going opposite way. And I think to myself, wait a minute, something's fishy here. You can't do that.
Well, with steroids, you think that I can finally start – throwing the ball more than 50 miles an hour?
No, maybe a little bit, but you got to have skills, too. You got to have the skills.
John from Paramus, hi. You're going to have the last word.
How you doing? Well, you're a class guy and a great Yankee. You always will be.
Thank you.
I want to know, who was the toughest pitcher that you had to face? And who gave you the hardest time? And who was the pitcher that you owned?
Oh, man, that's a good question.
Did you feel like you owned any pitchers? Like,
yeah, the Baltimore staff I owned. Scott McGregor, Mike Flanagan, Tippi Martinez. For some reason, they had a lot of left-handed pitchers, and I love hitting against lefties. So my lifetime average against the Orioles is off the charts. The guys that I didn't like facing, Nolan Ryan threw 100 miles an hour. That was not very comfortable.
Jack, and the Mets traded him away.
Yes, and Jack Morris with the Tigers had great stuff. Frank Tanana, when he first came up, a strong lefty, had not only the velocity, but he had a great changeup. I was fortunate that I had a good eye. So a lot of guys didn't really give me a tough time because I was always getting the favorable counts. I didn't swing at a lot of balls out of the zone, and I didn't miss a fastball. So if I got into a 2-1 count or a 3-1 count or 2-0 count, if you threw me a fastball, I usually execute it to play.
Willie Randolph's book is called The Yankee Way. Playing, Coaching, and My Life in Baseball. It's from It Books, which is an imprint of William Morrow. And Willie Randolph will be signing books tonight at the Book Review at 7 o'clock. That's in Huntington, Long Island. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Willie, thank you so much for being on our show today.
Lennon, I had a great time talking to you, man. Let's do it again. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And I forgot to mention, you'll also be at the Barnes & Noble store in the Bronx Tuesday.
Yes, I'll be there. And all my Yankee fans, come on out, guys, right around the corner.
That's at 7 o'clock.
Yes, yes.
And thank you so much for being here.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me.